deal to their guy. The 6 year we offered $32 million. The 8 year we offered $46 million. And both, when you look at comparables around the league, are very good.
John Davidson, president of the Columbus Blue Jackets. Those are the deals that they have offered Ryan Johansson. And still no deal. As a matter of fact, if you believe what you hear, Ryan Johansson's gone home to Vancouver. Very, very, very excited about this. Longtime fan of the East-West Hot Stove when it was on Primetime Sports in Toronto with Bob McCowan. It's been part of the program in the morning with Boomer and Rhett, and very excited we're moving it to the afternoons on Wednesday here as representing the East, Al Morganti from CBS Sports. Al, thanks for doing this.
No worries. Love it anytime in Calgary.
And our good friend Eric DeHatchuk representing the West. Mr. DeHatchuk, thank you. Now, I'm supposed to call you Tweedledee or Tweedledum. I can't remember.
Yeah, that's how you're supposed to start. And we're supposed to, you know, sort of digress off of something. Hey, I'll start.
Okay.
You know, I almost missed the very first one of your shows, Rob.
Why?
Here's what happened. Well, I filed my column. I was writing about the San Jose Sharks today. My son comes bounding down the stairs. He's got his running stuff on. I think, hey, what a great day for a run. We're drifting out about, we're 20 minutes in, and I think to myself, oh, my God, I've got to be on the radio in 20 minutes. I ran the hardest 20 minutes of about the last 2 years to get back here in time. And if I'm huffing and puffing, that is the reason.
So, Al, how about you? Did you put any hard work in for this afternoon, or are you okay?
Just a little biking, hit the golf ball a little bit, and then listen to the whining going on about free agents. You know, I actually like it because down here in the States, there's so much nonsense with the NFL. It's actually refreshing to hear contract woes.
Well, let's deal first. I do want to ask you about the contract woes of Columbus Blue Jackets, but I want to throw this one out for you, fellas. This comes courtesy of Ian Pulver. Free agents are not holdouts. They don't have contracts. Please show some respect to the players by calling them what they are, free agents. Al, are we disrespecting Ryan Johansson by calling him a holdout?
It's kind of borderline to me because it's kind of a quirky CBA they have. It's got this kind of shady area in between. I wish they had just gone and made everybody unrestricted, just gone a little longer with the entry-level things. But it's not really fair to say a holdout. They do have the legitimacy waiting for an offer sheet or whatever. But it seems like things sort of fall in line. And I in the case of what's going on in Columbus, I consider it a holdout. If he's headed back to Vancouver, don't stop there and don't stop at Victoria Island. Just keep going out into the ocean because this guy, to me, doesn't have a leg to stand on for the numbers that he is reportedly asking.
Yeah, it's a semantic distinction, and I don't know why, you know, people like Ian Pulver, who was with the Players Association during the Bob Goodenough run, get so bogged down in the vocabulary. The fact of the matter is, they are at an impasse in a contract negotiation, and I think the fact that Columbus went as public today with the numbers that they were offering was basically because they realized that they're in a battle for the high ground in the public relations war, and I think they felt that if they came out and said, you know, we have offered all of these different options to them and none of them seem to be relevant, that most people will look at it and say, okay, that's pretty good. If a guy wants to go long-term, $46 million is pretty good. If he wants to gamble and risk that he can do what P.K. Subban did and, you know, play for two more years, and if he has 2 years like he had last year, then he's going to be a $9 million player. So, I mean, the club in some respects is also playing Russian roulette because I think that if it turns out that the player is what they think he's going to be, then it's going to cost them more down the road by playing hardball right now. But I think that they're within the rights to use this particular provision of the CBA. It's the only time in the entire document that the leverage rests with the team. As soon as a player is out of this entry-level system, the leverage shifts to the player. So, you know, players use all the leverage that they possibly can in negotiations. That is their right. I have no problem with that. But I think that in this particular case, you know, it is wrong to criticize the team for using the leverage that they have as part of this document.
Al, it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but the only leverage the player has is either to withhold services or the offer sheet. There's nobody giving this kid an offer sheet right now, is there?
I don't think so. It's kind of odd because in the media, we kind of pump up the guy. I remember last year, the end of the year, going into the playoffs, I couldn't say enough good things about him. I mean, I'm on pregame, postgame, and I'm just saying, look, their future's so bright. Look at this guy. Look what he does so well. And then I'm coming down on the other side because, frankly, I don't see a body of work there where anybody would offer what it would take here. I just don't you have to have a little bit more of a pedigree to me to get the numbers that he's asking for. So an enormous, like, to me, P.K. Subban was much more likely. You could see the skill level there and more electrifying, in my opinion, a position that was more valuable. So I don't think that's going to be coming here. I think this is going to get a little nastier in the short term. And what the team has going for them here is, much as the Blue Jackets are big in that market and the mm-hmm. building can be loud, it's still not as important as the Ohio State quarterback going down. So he's not going to be missed as sorely as he thinks.
Rob, it's late in the game for an offer sheet. There's only a handful of teams that have the financial wherewithal to make that kind of an offer anyway. If it was earlier in the summer, it would be a different story. If it was earlier in the summer, you could think about it and say, okay, you know, if we do this, you know, we have to reserve a certain amount of cap space. We have to decide to give up, you know, future assets in terms of compensation if we happen to get the deal. I mean, it's funny that Calgary is one of the few teams in a position to possibly do this. Now, that is not the way that they operate here, but it would be very interesting for me if the Flames were to ever go to them and say, okay, what do you want for Ryan Johansson? And if you could negotiate a deal, because, you know, Brian Burke, as you know, opposes the yeah. concept of an offer sheet, but has in the past historically shown that he is willing to go out and make a trade for a player's rights. So, you know, that would be the one sort of thing. I mean, it's not going to happen, but it would be, if you're you know, debating the hypothetical, it would be a team that has the cap room of a Calgary, that has young assets that you could potentially flip and make a trade. And if you decided that this guy was a potential franchise player that you could build your team around, it would be something that you would have to at least consider as an organization.
It is the East-West Hot Stove, representing the East, Al Morgani from CBS Sports. The West, covered off by Eric DeHatchuk from the Globe and Mail here on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. Gentlemen, 10 years ago yesterday, we started the loss of a full season of the National Hockey League. The 04-05 wiped out. That season wiped out by a collective bargaining impasse. Al, 10 years later, what's the legacy of that particular lockout as you see it?
The legacy to me is what's improved on the ice. I don't give any marks to the commissioner for shutting down the league so often. I've said before, when he gets in the Hall of Fame, they should shut it down 2 days a week. That's what he did to this league. But the best thing to come out of it was the people behind the scenes that worked on the rules to open up the game. I think it's a far, far more entertaining product since that time. I like what they've done in terms of offense. I like the game better since that time. You do have this little quirky CBA where you've got the situation going on in Ottawa and in Columbus. But I think for the most part, they've cleaned things up there. It's not like it was previously. So you're going to have labor peace for a while. But I really do think that was a huge demarcation line for me in terms of where the game was going, how it was called, and how it was going to open up.
Yeah, same thing. I mean, I'm actually working on that as the story that we're going to probably run as part of our season preview. You know, 10 years after the fact, how has the game fundamentally changed? How have coaches had to react to the way the game changed? I mean, I'll just use one small example. I mean, part of the rule package that came in 2005, 2006, when they finally settled this thing, was the shootout, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if you remember, how did people approach the shootout in the first year of the shootout? It was kind of a lark. Ha, 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 here we are. Okay, let's send three guys out. People laugh on the bench. It was almost like something that you see at a shinny hockey game. You go next, you go next, you go next. And suddenly, over time, people realize, hey, you know, we got to treat this more seriously. We're leaving points on the table. And now, you know, the players who potentially are in the shootout will look at videotape. Goalies will study the moves of other players. I mean, it's become part of the coaching fabric because, you know, a team like New Jersey last year, if they'd been better in the shootout, they would have made the playoffs. If Washington had been better, if Nashville had been better in the shootout. So that's just a small example of how coaches have had to adjust. They've had to change the style that they played when they took out the red line. The game is faster. The defensemen now, you know, they get clobbered because there's no holdups in the game. And Al is right. You know, the game is faster. It's more entertaining. And we've seen two spectacular playoffs coming out of the last lockout that really, I think, has helped lure the fans back because they just like what they see on the ice. It's you know, the product is just head and shoulders better than it was 10 years ago.
Here's the problem I have with that particular point, and it's purely a numbers thing, but according to Sports Illustrated, in 03-04, there was an average of 5.13 goals per game. This past season, 5.34, Al, it doesn't seem like that big an increase. Is it? Are we just talking about goals, or are we talking about the overall play is better?
I think the overall play, I think the ability to come back in a game, it didn't exist previously. Back then, you know, the Devils get a lead. They should have just taken the scoreboard and put it down on the ice. Ain't nobody getting through. And I think what you have now is two-goal lead, not safe anywhere. And look at what happens in the playoffs even. That's all changed.
Yeah.
And you can look at numbers any way you want. The goalies are terrific. But you know that a two-goal lead can evaporate so quickly. No matter what the total number of goals is, there's nothing safe about it watching the game with the opportunities that I've had. You can make a number of saves, but if there's a number of shots on net, a number of good scoring opportunities, that makes the game that much more entertaining.
I think there's more that lifts you out of your seat, Rob. I mean, I think back to the way the game was played prior to 2004, 2005, and they were exercises in tedium. You know, so many times in a regular season game, it would be hard to stick with something from the start to the finish. As Al says, you know, once a team got ahead, they were really good at locking it down. The stats for teams leading after two periods were 40-0. I mean, it was very, very rare that a team would come back before that. You know, so you introduce the shootout, which gives you a decision in every game, and then you just free up the players to show their skills. So not every time one of those plays ends up in the back of the net, but it does enough times. And even if it doesn't end up in the back of the net, you think to yourself, wow, that was a heck of a play by Johnny Gaudreau. I mean, he didn't score the other day in the last Rookie Stars game. By all accounts, he still put on a show.
Let me do this. It's East-West Hot Stove here on Sportsnet 960. Al Morganti and Eric DeHatchuk. Al, I'm going to put you in the position of you're going to be the owner and the manager of a brand new NHL team, and you get to build it from scratch. Are you going to have a captain and two alternates? Are you going to have four alternates? Montreal is not going to have a captain this year. San Jose might not. Columbus hasn't for the last couple of years. Do you need a captain and two alternates?
You don't need it. It's funny. I had this argument this morning on a radio show here on how important was the captaincy. You know, you had an Edmonton team where, you know, Messier is the great leader, but, you know, it was Wayne. I don't think you necessarily need it. I feel more comfortable with it as a hockey fan. Maybe it's just some cultural lag to me. I feel like the locker room is better served with that. And selfishly, from a media standpoint, it's the guy who sort of has to answer the questions. And I think that goes a pretty far way in developing a player. I would never make a player a captain thinking it would make him a better player. I think that's the mistake a lot of teams make. I do think in Montreal, however, I think this Subban thing, I really think he wanted it. I don't think he had to read too far between the lines here. And I think he did a lot in the playoffs to prove how much committed he is. For whatever reason, the commitment seems more on Subban's part than that team still to me. I would have had no problem with him making him the captain there. San Jose is kind of I think they're kind of waiting for that next wave to come on before they do anything. But it is an interesting argument. I like the fact that hockey has it. I watched the Boston Red Sox when Veritek was the captain, and it was an important cog to their team, and other teams, other sports seem to be going that way. I hope it's never lost. I really like it. Makes the sport special to me when you have a guy wearing that C.
I think you need a captain if you have the right individual for it. You know, so when Jerome McGinley left Calgary, it was pretty clear to a lot of people that the next logical captain was Mark Giordano, who had played a long time, was well-liked in the dressing room, had a kind of quiet leadership ability, and had evolved into one of the better players on the ice. I don't think you need a captain when you're in a transitional year. And so I'll make the case that Montreal, I know a lot of people think that they're just, you know, that it was a non-decision. I think they're buying time. I spoke to PK about this last Monday. We talked for about 15 minutes, and I think about half our conversation was about the captaincy. He told me something I didn't know, which is that he'd never even worn a letter in Montreal. So first we talked about whether he wanted to wear a letter. Absolutely. What if that letter was the C? I would absolutely embrace it. But he said, we have a group of about four or five people that are the key leaders on the team, and ultimately, you know, to me, leadership is about laying it on the line every night as a player, and that's how you lead, and that doesn't change if you have a C, an A, or no letter at all. So I do think they're holding that for him. I think that if they'd put Markov in for a year or two, until the end of his career, I think that would have been okay. I suspect he's going to be the captain next year, and that's the reason that they didn't want to designate it. And I believe that Ottawa is going to do the same thing with Erik Karlsson. He is going to be the captain of the Ottawa Senators in time. But this is the first chance that Erik Karlsson has had to come back from that injury after a summer of full training. And so I think they want Karlsson to concentrate on the game of hockey on the ice and not have to deal with all of the extra baggage that comes with being a captain, knowing full well that one or two years down the road he's going to be that guy, and hopefully he'll be physically in a better position, a bit more mature, and able to embrace it the way Daniel Alfredsson did for all those years in Ottawa.
One last quick one for you. Al, best captain in hockey right now?
Wow. I actually like Crosby for the work ethic of a star. When you watch him at practice and what he goes through, and the fact that he's a superstar, and I've seen it so many times, is all-inclusive with teammates. And although I think things went off the rails in Pittsburgh and his efforts, but you can't argue with the work ethic on what he does.
Yeah, I'll go with Taves, but Crosby's a great choice, too. I mean, Jonathan Taves, I mean, they've won two championships with him as the captain. He leads, he was the leader of Team Canada at the Olympics. He's a guy, even without the C in Sochi, he was one of the key people in the leadership role, and he just does a dynamic job in Chicago right now.
Couldn't trip you guys up on the first day. We'll try better next Wednesday. Al Morganti from CBS Radio, thank you, sir. Eric DeHatchek from the Globe and Mail, thank you, sir. Guys, it's been a lot of fun. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
Thanks, guys.